I don't think the medical board will have an issue with it because we just have not seen that in other states where this has been identified. And so it is our hope that that happens. I know that Ali will probably have some comments on this as well, and that he has a meeting coming up in August about that. And a little bit cautiously optimistic to move that direction, and that's where we're at with that.
So specifically, Mrs. Harrow, we are no longer talking about a 1305 permit, correct?
Ms. Brady, again, yes, that is correct. So this would be a 1304 permit where the vetting of the CRNA would be an application that is, will be asking questions such as similar that is asked of us about disciplinary action, things that may be happening with our own permitting of general anesthesia, but in the relevance of the non-dentist anesthesia provider.
And that 1304 permit would be held by the non-dentist anesthesia provider?
That is correct.
Staff, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Do you foresee any potential issues the dental board having with permitting a non-dentist anesthesia provider?
Absolutely.
Could you explain, please?
You don't regulate them. And requiring them to apply, you would, in essence, be regulating them. That would, I don't believe you'd be able to do that in rule. You would have to expand your authority in statute first.
This is German. Dr. Brady, are there not states that issue non-dentist anesthesia providers permits?
This is Brady. Yes, they do. In California, there's such language.
So this is Jeremy again. Is there any way around that thought process, Seth?
This is Brady, real quick. It, in the California language, it specifically specifies that it's non-punitive or meant to be where they're governing. It's only the ability for the anesthesia that's held within the dental facility to be permitted from the dental board. So they can only issue and remove permits. They can't put sanctions or do anything with their license. There's very specific language probably to mitigate that same issue.
This is German, but they can remove the permit from that provider?
That is correct.
Thus effectively preventing them from providing anesthesia in dental offices?
That is correct.
Ali, do you care to comment?
Yeah. So what Dr. Brady mentioned in this, you know, he mentioned the potential of doing a moratorium of understanding between boards. So where effectively the dental board and the nursing board and the dental board and the medical board would be working together in this regard to permit the non-dentist to the non-dentist anesthesia providers to be able to carry a what would end up becoming the 1304 permit. You know, we had a pretty robust discussion at the last meeting, and you know, in my mind, the thing that Dr. Brady mentioned that I think resonates the most for me is that no matter what, with the 1304 permit as it stands, bringing in a non-dentist anesthesia provider, you know, much of the burden of responsibility does fall on the dentist who carries the 1304 permit for the anesthesia, and really they shouldn't bear that responsibility. So I think it makes a lot of sense. I did speak with one of my contacts, who's a CRNA on the board of nursing, about how she feels this might work. She thinks that it could be figured out, basically, and she invited me to attend. They have an APRN, Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Subcommittee of the Nursing Board, much like this committee, you know, making suggestions and proposed changes for the Board of Dentistry. This APRN committee is essentially the decision makers for basically all matters relating to advanced practice nurses. So she invited me to come to that meeting. What we discussed in our subcommittee of this committee was that we would try and get some language together of, you know, utilizing some of the things that California did and then have something, you know, in writing that I could present to that committee and basically get their approval. You know, I think what Seth mentions is carries a lot of weight about regulating non-dentists, and I think it would have to be done in a way that you know, the two boards are working together. And interestingly enough, when I asked this board member about if she feels that the nursing board and the dental board could come together and work on this together for the regulatory side of it, she said, absolutely, we're actually statutorily mandated that the regulating boards have to work together. So I think we can accomplish this. Personally, I know, you know, obviously I'm not a lawyer like Seth is, but my thought is that if the boards are working together, that the dental board, the only punitive thing that the dental board could do is say, hey, we don't want this provider in dental offices, but it's not taking away their ability to practice anywhere else, then, you know, and really the true, you know, reprimanding authority falls on the board of nursing. I think it could work, but as I said, I'm not a lawyer. I just, from speaking to that member of the nursing board, you know, I think we could get there. And of course, we would need approval from the medical board as well. You know, as Dr. Brady mentioned, in other states that hasn't been an issue. You know, in California, it wasn't an issue, but nonetheless, we'll obviously, you know, we'd have to be working with them as well.
Jessica, you've got your hand raised.
I do. Yes, thank you. I have concerns, not necessarily along the legal lines, but I see where Seth is coming from. And I'd also like to point out that from a rulemaking standpoint, if you're looking to put something into rule about a new permit or expanding a current permit to another set of individuals, you do have to show statutory authority in order to make those rules or to expand those rules. And again, based on what Seth was saying, I don't know that you can show that statutory authority without making a statutory change.
Thank you, Jessica.
This is Blazek. Can someone tell me what a statutory change is?
I can.
Yeah.
This is Ryan, or Seth, who was that? Was that you, Seth?
No, that was me. Sorry.
Okay. So a statutory change is where you meet with lawmakers across the street, essentially with legislative members, either from the House or Senate. And they go through the whole process of the legislative calendar to take a bill and make it a statutory provision. So statute, in essence, is a synonymous term to a law. And a rule is just a rule. And you can't have a rule without a statutory authority to give the rule.
Thank you.
Jessica, you probably would have done better. Did I do okay?
You did pretty good, Ryan.
Thanks.
This is Christensen. What would the permitting process look like for the facilities then, Dr. Brady?
This is Brady. So again, where the 1301 permit has a mobile permit and they've shown and credentialed all of their equipment and like keeping and whatever the rules may be for that checklist, the same would apply for the 1304 permit where they'd have to have that verification. Intended to be kind of thought of, and it's very still just rough because we haven't had really a full subcommittee meeting about it, but would be to have an attestation in place to be able to issue temporary permits that would give a window of a year for someone to go and do the actual process of, okay, this is what you need, this is what you have, this has been checked off by a board staff.
And then they would be, this is Christensen again, then they would be subject to you know, their every 5 years being examined or having somebody come in like we do similar to all the other permitting process.
This is Brady holders. Again. So the idea behind that is that we probably would propose a rule change with the live patient evaluations for all permit holders when it comes to general anesthesia from people coming from a coded accredited programs or from the anesthesia providers for that 1301 or 1304 for the non-dental anesthesia providers.
Who, Christensen again, who would then be providing those examinations? Could it be a 1301 permit holder to a 1304? Could a 1304 permit a 1301? What is your vision there?
So for that process to occur, it would have to be a 1301, so like a 1304. But the idea behind it is more so, okay, do you have these things in order? Do you have these things checked off? There could be a calibration. It could be even a subcommittee within the dental board itself within a panel to evaluate those things. I know in Mississippi, they made the anesthesia advisory panel kind of a perpetual panel for the board to help with them. And I did send some language over about tort law and reform and things like that that would evolve if this became a permanent type of committee. So it would be up to that committee to help get volunteers organized to go out and calibrate those investigators to see what they're going to look for.
So that, Christensen again, so they would then have a subject that would be sedated. They would, I know you mentioned the checklist, but I mean, every other permit holder has to have a live patient essentially to.
This is Brady again. And I know, and I'm trying not to muddy the waters because I know a little bit kind of goes in hand with that. I think a separate discussion would be, is that a viable practice that we do already? And does it have meaning and weight with anesthesia providers in the state of Arizona? Have we had new residents coming out and getting evaluations that have failed that type of evaluation for live patient experience? And then there's also some ethical questions, whether having an evaluation and examination on a live patient, there are some concerns with that as well. And so that's, I think if it was to hold true with one provider, that we still continue with that, I think that would have to hold true with all providers the same way. And if we were to eliminate that, it would be the same with all providers.
You're talking only though within the 1301.
That is correct.
Right.
That is correct because of the standards that are held within
right.
residency.
Correct.
Code of standards and educational goals that are met.
All these have a hand up. Let me just get this video. We'll come back to you.
Ollie? Yeah, I just had a couple other comments based on Dr. Christensen's let me lower my hand. What Dr. Christian was asking, one thing just thinking about California in regards to who does the on-site evaluations, in California what they outline is that it's actually done by a like professional. So a physician anesthesiologist would have a physician anesthesiologist that's doing the on-site. I don't think it has to be that way necessarily. And obviously, it certainly couldn't be from the start when you don't actually – when it's a new thing and there aren't any non-dentists with these permits. But just saying that's what they do in California. And then, the question about the facility permitting, I just want to kind of be clear from my understanding of this. There is no facility permitting as it stands right now. It's just the individual dentist. If we want to change that, I think that's a different conversation, but, that's what it is now. And then just kind of going back, I have a question for Jessica and Seth regarding the regulatory authority, the statutory authority. Do the two of you feel like what we discussed in the last meeting of having a 1304 that still goes to dentists and this 1305 certificate that goes to non-dentists, would that be better or is it kind of the same? And either way, we got to kind of figure it out and navigate those waters.
I believe at that meeting I expressed my concern about that option as well.
Okay. Okay, that's all I have for now. Thank you.
It's hypothetical. It doesn't matter. We'll get to it. We'll get to it.
Right.
Well, let's talk about that last point you brought up. Because, I'd like to hear the opinion of the committee members where the conversation had taken place about doing away with the site evaluation and a live patient exam for 1301 permit holders that have finished oral surgery and dental anesthesia residencies, and then that would carry over to the 13. If, however, we end up having a permit go to whether it's the dentist or the CRNA or MD, but if you've finished a COTA accredited residency, are we really gaining anything by doing these on-site evaluations and live patient exams?
And this is great. I'm sorry. I just want to make my opinion a little bit more clear so that it's understood. As far as the site evaluation, I do see credibility in that. It's more questioning the live patient experience with the board member there that I draw into question a little bit more. I think it's appropriate to be able to bring someone in, especially a new provider, even if it's just more so of an educational and teaching opportunity. I think there's value in that, because then it's like, okay, this is what's expected while you're in this dental office. Even though you've read it and you understand it, it shows the applicable part of it, like looking at forms. How are you pre-oping? How are you doing your informed consent? How are you preparing for the day? What are these drugs for you? I understand that value and that safety net that's in place. The live patient experience, I have a different opinion about that, just because if you're coming from a COTA accredited program, you had already done and have shown proficiency to someone or some institution to a certain level. But now being challenged to that patient, I don't know, like, okay, now I've missed the ideal in this patient because I'm a little bit nervous and it's my first time and it's not, you know, but these other people and I've got other, you know, viewpoints on me. I think it's a little bit not maybe obtaining the goal or the intent that it originally thought that it would. It may also be that if you're going to be selecting a sedation patient that you want to do in an evaluation versus in real life, it's probably like, I'm going to choose this
right.
5-minute procedure. Right. So I guess that's where I question that a little bit. And I think drawing that back just a touch helps with the regulatory issue, the statute issue that we have. Like, we can't govern these other providers, but yet we're inviting them into our house to do anesthesia. So I think it kind of helps with that.
This is Snell. My question would be, it's, you need to have a periodontist that gets moderate sedation training in his residency, or many general dentists that do GPRs, AGDs that are accredited residency programs, that would that extend down to those individuals as well, or is it only if you're applying for a 1301?
This is Brady again. I think those standards are very, very different, and I don't mean that to be dismissive of my periodontist colleagues, but I just know with periodontists, there's a big breadth of educational experience with them. I know, and like LSU, they get a ton of sedation and general anesthesia exposure, where other ones don't get any at all. And so I think there's a little bit more, because their focus really isn't anesthesia, where those standards are very hyper-focused from the general anesthesia standpoint for oral surgeons and dentist anesthesiologists. So there's also the moderate sedation where you're coming in from a CE educational background, and there's a lot of different CE educational backgrounds in all of these of those programs. Because I don't know, like, my opinion for that is completely different, and I don't mean to be, hey, this works for me, but not for you type of regulatory thought process in my mind, but I think there is a clear definitive difference between those types of standards.
This is Snell again. I agree. I just think you get into a little, if you're talking about accredited programs, the CE courses, there's no accreditation, right? There's nothing that the board, there's no educational, but a perio program, they have to list out, this is what we do. And you might even put in there, like it has now, you have to have X amount of numbers of cases coming from an accredited program. But I think you might run into a difficult line if you start seeing these specialists don't have to have in a live patient portion of it, but these other specialists do. I don't know.
All right. This is Brady. I think also the thought process of that is we've talked to trying to be as balanced as we can. And I know the 1304 has its issues with, okay, everyone has to have a 1304 and I have to go through the song and dance every single time with all these different dentists. that may or may not even understand what sectional polling is. There's a bit I'm required to even have to be present working. But at the same sense, they're not having that live patient evaluation done. And so then you see the flip side of the dentist that is under the purview of the dental board having to do these live patient experiences. Those are the disbalances that I'm trying to balance out. I understand what you're saying. There may be some pushback within our modern sedation colleagues within their residencies and their training to say, well, if that's good for this level, why isn't this good for my appropriate level too?
This is Snell. I would agree in the general principle of if you went to some institution that was accredited by said, you know, CODA or whatever it is that you're proficient to do anesthesia coming out, and now we have to go back and say, hey, come in and give this patient anesthesia or sedation and let me watch you. And is that really claiming that they're proficient and safe? As we've said, hey, if you come out of this residency program, you can place implants and do wisdom teeth and all the other stuff, but we're not so sure about the sedation part of it. That seems a little different to me. So I would agree with Dr. Brady's assessment on that.
This is Blazek, and I'll just jump in here about the evaluation thing and what have you. Is, you know, having done a lot of them, like you guys, I've never not passed somebody because of how they did the sedation or the general anesthetic. They do a good job. They nail it. They know how to put people to sleep and stuff. Where I don't pass people is when their office isn't set up right. They have their LMAs in one area and the endotracheal tubes in another area, and they can't find a McGill's forceps. That's the office I don't pass.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would agree with you, and I think, you know, I'm speaking for our whole society. I don't think the big thing is the actual anesthetic procedure. It's making sure that the individual has the appropriate equipment in the office and understands where it's located. And then we go a step further. We ask the staff a lot of questions when we do our evaluations because we want to make sure staff knows where the sucks is. If your doctor asks you to get this, you know, so it really is about the site, not so much about how good they do anesthesia because they came from a credit program. Pretty much know what they're doing. Yeah. So
I would add, though, that it is difficult to get that concept or to see that visualized without a live patient there. And it tends to just bring things to light, and you can kind of see how the movement of the office is and where things are. And there's never been a site visit that I've gone to for as an evaluator where I've had somebody come in and evaluate me that haven't learned something. And I think that's important that we keep that in mind. I mean, it's not necessarily, you know, just checking off because I think there's a lot of things that come up that could help protect people to come into that office down the road. So,
Ms. Brady, I appreciate both of you guys' viewpoint on that. You guys have actually are out there doing these evaluations. I've been involved in simulation a lot. And
with the simulation.
Yeah. It may be that that's a happy medium spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have to be a high fidelity sim man, but we definitely could create such a stressful situation to see how they react and how they react with it. Well, not only their staff, but also with their equipment and doing the same thing. So maybe there's some way to like make that a little better without undermining some of those good points. That's pretty nice.
Dr. Caputo, you got your hand up.
Yeah, I just was curious. I think it was Dr. Blazek who said something about we go a step further and we talk to the staff, and I didn't quite understand what that meant.
This is Blazek. So either during the anesthetic procedure or after or before, we'll say, hey, you know, if you're with this patient and they start coughing, but, you know, we simulate an emergency and we ask the staff how they respond.
Well, how come that's a step further, I guess, is what I don't understand.
Well, because I think that if most of the evaluations I've done have been in an oral surgeon's office. So I go in there and I know that the doctor's, you know, practicing what I would call a team model where he has three or four other individuals that he relies on. When I do an evaluation for a general dental office for a moderate sedation, you often find that the assistant or the front desk personnel will not have any idea about how they're supposed to proceed in the case of an emergency. And so we try to emphasize that, you know, it's not just the doctor providing the anesthetic. It's about the whole office being able to respond to some kind of an adverse occurrence or untoward effect or event, excuse me.
I guess my only comment is what I think I hear you saying is it's an extra step to talk to the staff, but it's actually part of the evaluation to ensure that the staff is a functioning, understanding member of the team. And that gets checkmarked off. So it really shouldn't be considered an extra step. It's what every evaluator should be doing and spending time with that staff. I just was just looking for clarification there, not to get too much in the weeds. I'll only make one other comment. I could say about categorically, I'll certainly look to any of the board staff to confirm or deny this statement, but I think in any adverse event that's ever occurred with a permitted dentist, the evaluation never came up as an issue in any shape or form. So I'm just looking at this at the other end, that we look at these evaluations, while I see them having some level of purpose, and I certainly appreciate the idea of going to an office, and I really like the way I think Dr. Blazek said it earlier about looking more at about how an office is organized, set up, and how they know how to do things versus actually seeing a patient sedated or put under deep sedation or general anesthesia. But tying it into the adverse outcome end, when adverse outcomes occur with any permitted dentist, almost positive, the evaluation never comes up as an issue. And I just think that's something to reflect on as we consider what role that really has in this process. Thank you.
This is Snell again. Just off of Dr. Fu's comment, to make it clear what's in the visit, the on-site inspection evaluation form, there's two things that regard to staff. Did the staff involved with the demonstration hold a current healthcare provider CPR? And then did the staff know the location of emergency drugs and equipment? Now, it's up for debate if we want to increase what the knowledge of the staff needs, but that's what's currently the questions that are asked on the form that we go around the site evaluations to do. So.
So. Again, primary issue, I think, is this 1304 permit, and I'm concerned that I like the idea. I think, you know, we're headed in a direction. Ideally, that would be great, but, you know, there is real concern that we're going to get pushback that we're trying to regulate providers we can't regulate. And so, you know, that to me is kind of the primary issue we need to talk through, and because all these other portions of the rules, there, I don't think it'll take this committee as much time to work out. So have we thought about where we go if in the end it's looked at that we are now trying to regulate non-dental anesthesia providers and we can't do that?
This is Brady. We did kind of explore alternate options for that. We didn't have a real defined or and focused plan for that, and I'd ask that we continue those efforts and subcommittee to develop an alternate plan as well in parallel to our next meeting.
Okay.
So that we would know some more information for that alternate plan and also get some feedback from the nursing board side to see what their opinion is about the actual ability to do this.
This is Blazek, and, you know, I just really want to, you know, commend you guys on how hard you've been working on it, and I would say that we're really moving in a good direction here, and you have this subcommittee of 9 people, all from various backgrounds in dentistry and medicine, and we all seem to think it's a pretty good idea, and they have 2 other states that they were able to accomplish it, so I really don't see it as a roadblock. If we're the committee who's supposed to be making the recommendations, and maybe I'm being naive, and I apologize, then that's the direction we move. I mean, it's a good idea. I like it. Almost everyone on the committee thinks it's a pretty good idea. It'd be great to get it vetted on a piece of paper and actually be able to read it. Then we utilize our resources, Jessica and Seth, and we say, how do we get this done? And, you know, Ali goes to the nursing board and, you know, maybe not Dr. German, but we make contact with the medical board and we say, this is the passionately want to move forward. Here's two other states who have done it, and we think it's good by us, the dental board. So I don't know. I don't see the real big problem.
Good. Thank you. And I don't mean to put you on
the spot. No, that's fine. No, I'm up there. Hot seat. I know I was in the penalty box today.
Well, then, I mean, like we just summed up, I don't think there's much more purpose in going through this portion of the rules today. I think, you know, it's just behind the scenes work to, you know, see what we can accomplish and that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank
agreed.
You, Dr. Brady. Dr. I mean, everybody's been putting a lot of time in, but I know you've been putting an exceptional amount of time, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you for everyone.
Thank you. So, does any other committee member want to talk about any portion of the rules right now?
I think Dr. Loud may wanted to speak about pediatrics. If there's time on the agenda for that.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you want to address your?
Yeah, I there's one thing. Me and this is Loud. Me and Dr. Beanstalk, I think early in the game, back in September, we put together some changes for the 1303 permit. I made the mistake of highlighting blue and green, and maybe that's why it didn't make it to the red line. But there are changes. We actually, I think the committee approved it back then. So we're working on trying to get that into this document. I talked to Sherry about it. We'll continue to do that. But I know we just got a couple things. We got the guidelines for teaching pediatric pain control and sedation in dentists and dental students. I think this is a very good reference for consideration for those that are not CODA approved that do a CE course in pediatric sedation. I think there's some good guidelines in this document. I also think the American Society of Dental Anesthesiologists has got some, the recent document that you guys put out. Has some good resources for that. That being said, mine and Lisa's kind of similar to that. So I think we've got some good things as far as how to have guidelines in place for somebody that's not a pediatric dentist or didn't do an AGT or an AET and is familiar with pediatrics. At our meeting, was it Thursday night, last Thursday? I think we had discussed pediatrics, and we determined that we were going to use the less than 8. Category for pediatrics. I think that's in a couple resources as far as that goes. John, did you want to kind of take us from there?
So, yeah, this is German talking. We purposely did not make any more green, blue, or red line edits because I think we wanted to have more of a discussion before we actually made any actual propositions. But the thought process was, you know, Dr. Beanstalk, I don't know if she's on via phone or virtually, but she has mentioned a couple times in this committee that, you know, kids are not adults and therefore should not be treated as adults. And, you know, that statement is based obviously on the fact that kids are different than adults, anatomically, physiologically, even metabolically, and they respond differently under anesthesia. And that's been validated over and over again. And so the question is, should they be treated differently? Should we hold our anesthesia providers to a different standard who care for those patients, that patient population, which, you know, Dr. Beanstalk and Dr. Lau, I think, had successfully argued for the 1303 permit when they did so. This concept of required number cases to prove competency or at least suggest competency with providers is nothing new. We are all subject to those numbers and requirements in our training programs. All medical staff organizations across the country have standards of case requirements before you can actually do certain cases, and that could be surgical cases, it could be anesthesia cases in age groups and so forth. For me to do kids at Phoenix Children's, I have to show that I've done 50 cases over a two-year period. If I go to Cardin Children's, I got to do 25 cases over a two-year period. Oral surgeons have to do at least 1 month of their minimum 5 months of anesthesia training in pediatrics. Dentists, anesthesiologists have to do a certain number of pediatric cases. So the question is, should we require an extra level of competency potentially proven by case logs of our anesthesia providers? I would suggest the answer would be yes, that we require a certain they require proof of doing cases. There's a certain level of familiarity, which would then lend to a certain level of safety.
8 of our 20 cases from this state alone involve kids under 8 years old. So it's not an insignificant issue that we're facing. I mean, kids are, you know, they're having adverse outcomes. And if we have providers who have not taken care of that age group for a year, two, three, or four, or five, or more, heaven forbid, and now they've got a six-year-old under their care who has a laryngospasm, bradycardia, asystole, and has not ever taken care of a COAT situation or been in that familiarity or intubated a child of that size, we have a problem that could potentially have been prevented had they had we held them to a different standard. So my suggestion, or what I'd like to do, is I'd like to require, similar to what Dr. Lout is asking for 1303, for all sedation permits, that if you want to take care of kids under 8 or whatever age group we decide, that you prove that you've been able to take care of that age group over a certain period of time and for whatever number we as a subcommittee decide is appropriate. So that's kind of the discussion. That's the opening to the discussion. I'm just curious to hear what the subcommittee thinks or feels about this.
Dr. Beanstock, did you have your
hand?
I'm saying bravo, well said.
What'd she say?
Can you hear me?
She said it was okay said, not well said, but just part of it.
Well, if I'd known you were on, you could have said it a lot better.
Ollie, you got your hand up?
Yeah, I just want to put out there one thing just to, before the discussion, I think to make myself and Dr. Blazek and Dr. Christensen feel like we can kind of involve in the conversation and who we're talking about a little bit better. Regarding the suggested amendments in there, you know, it says, you know, that these requirements are going to be for those who have not completed a postdoctoral residency program. So the way it's kind of worded right now, it basically says that, you know, because dentist anesthesiologists and physician anesthesiologists complete a postdoctoral residency program, but oral surgeons and CRNAs, that's not exactly what we're doing when we do our anesthesia training that involves a requirement of pediatric anesthesia. So just so that we can think a little bit more clearly of who we're talking about this requirement for, I just want to kind of put out there, if we could change that verbiage just to say who have not completed an accredited anesthesia training program. By doing that, then that's going to include oral surgeons and CRNAs as the exclusion of these extra requirements and kind of focus on that we're really talking about, a dentist that doesn't have formal anesthesia training and what those requirements would be. So I just kind of wanted to kind of clear the air on that one first to make sure that we're good on that. Since I think once that is out of the way, Christensen, Blazek, and I can think a little more analytically about, these proposed requirements.
Okay. This is Lout. Oral surgery is considered a postdoctoral residency program. So that kind of eliminates that. We could always add verbiage to postdoctoral residency programs or certified nurse anesthetist programs. So
okay.
I think that would be an easy remedy to take care of. Also going back to what Dr. Germain was talking about, I know when we're the 1303 permit, we're required to show 10 cases of provide documentation for 10 cases of sedations for the past 5 years. So as far as 1303, that's already in place. We could always change the verbiage to 8 of those have to be in children less than 8 or, 7 have to be in those less than 6 or something like that. And that's something that we can talk about in discussion. But I agree with Dr. Drummond. Most of these situations that occur on kids, I think the majority are less than 6 years of age, correct?
Correct. Yep. Yeah, and I think it's the renewal case requirements 10 per year.
10 per year. Yep.
Yeah, not 10.
And if we need to get specific and list a certain age, we can.
Yeah, and that's for every permit. In fact, I think even if there's 1301s, you have to show 10 per year. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you're initially applying, it's 25, greater than 25 patients. If you've been 3 years out or more from residency.
Yeah, if you haven't, it's 10 or more.
That's what it says.
And then 10 or more.
10 or more. So this is Blazek, and you are right about that. If you haven't, when you come out of residency,
you've got the numbers.
You're fine. Or if you haven't practiced for 3 years, then you have to show proficiency. I think that one of the issues I have with the pediatric designation, and in particular, some of the wonderful, you know, documentation you have, Dr. German, is that I don't think it necessarily takes into account the type of surgeries we're doing, as well as the surgeons or the anesthesia providers' opportunity to evaluate the patient and kind of look at them as like, is this a patient that I can do in my office at whatever age it is, whether it's a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, or an 8-year-old, and we're assigning an 8-year-old number kind of I think it's arbitrarily. I won't say that the anatomic differences versus a 12-year-old, I get that, you know, but there's some 8-year-old patients that you look at and I say, this is a 20-minute procedure. I know I can do an open airway case, and I think I should have the opportunity to make that decision. And I know you're not saying, well, we're not going to let you, but I think to put an onus on, I'm going to just speak for maxillofacial surgeons, to all of a sudden start documenting all these cases that we do, 8 years old is a pretty high age group, because right now we're all doing them on all ages, you know, down to 4 and 3 years old. And none of the cases that we're looking at here involve an oral surgeon, and none of them involve these kind of small little cases, which is what most oral surgery is. So I think we're talking about two different types of procedures. These adverse occurrences we've had in our state are full mouth dentistry, multiple hour type surgeries, as well as I think some of the cases that we, if we read the literature that you referenced, they're not these small little cases that we do. And I think that's why oral surgery has had such a safe record, is because a lot of our training is patient selection. And if I have a case that's going to be a 2 to 3 hour anesthetic and the patient's going to have to be intubated, well, then I don't do that case in my office. Then we go to the OR and stuff. So if we make arbitrary numbers like this and we say, okay, we want to know every case you do less than 8 years old and you got to do at least 10 a year, that's an area that I would say that is going to detour our ability to deliver care to patients.
So thanks, Randy. This is German. So the age was arbitrary. In fact, Amos says 8. That's what they define children. The guidelines set out by the American Academy of Pediatrics along with pediatric dentistry cited 6 years old. So there's this range between 6 and 8. And I think that's up for debate among this committee. As far as safety, you know, you have a 6-year-old, you're going to do a little longer, might need intubation or a little more sedation. You'll take them to the hospital. Can you say that about every oral maxillofacial surgeon?
No, you can't.
You can't.
Like anything, yeah.
And so I guess that's my point, you know, and kids are dying all across the country under the hands of all specialties, right? So, I think there's a certain level of commitment that we owe to our patients and to the community to at least say that if you go into this office with your 6-year-old, you're going to know that that provider has taken care of X number of 6-year-olds or that age group over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be someone who hasn't touched a 6-year-old in 5 years. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of where I'm coming from with my suggestions, is that there's a minimum. And I'm not set on a number, Randy, you know.
Yeah.
We can talk about that. And I'm not trying to affect people's practices or bottom line. None of these decisions affect me whatsoever, obviously, and it potentially could affect everyone else in this room, depending on your practice. But I'm just trying to think of standards are set all across the country, and they have been from the day we entered into our training programs. The board has standards when they require certain case numbers for renewal of application of permits. Hospitals require certain standards. So why not provide that safety net, or at least that assurance to our community that we're thinking along those same lines when we're taking care of young kids in offices. That's where I'm coming from.
This is Dr. Beanstalk. Dr. Germain, thank you. Very, very, very well said. I'm actually very excited. You said it so, so well. Dr. Blazek, I wanted to ask you, is there a number and age you would feel more comfortable with? What number would you have in mind?
Well, I think if I was talking to the oral surgeons that I represent, I kind of think that's what I'm here doing. They would say 4 and under would be their age. And I think that's because if you asked them how many cases do you do, they probably wouldn't really know. But to say, do you do 20 a year or every 2 years? I don't think that would probably not be accurate. I don't think any maxillofacial guy does 20 5-year-old and under per year, if that's what we're asking for. I kind of looked at my numbers, and I know I don't do that many. In 10 years, I did 20. That's for 5 years old. If I looked at 8 and under, I did 220. So it's just such a huge difference between that number of 4 to 5 years old and then 8. You know, that's kind of where it was just been such a burden to try to track it all.
This is Ali. I just have a thought on it, thinking on the patient safety side of it, right? There's a huge difference between a 2-year-old and an 8-year-old, right? There's not a great deal of difference between like an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old. They're different, right? But not as dramatically as 2 and 8. So if you have this, so just thinking like on the other side of things and the safety and the renewal and the qualifications. So if you have a provider that's done 100 7-year-olds in a year, but 7-year-old is the youngest that they've done, does that qualify them to take care of an 18-month-old?
No.
This is German. The answer, I think the short answer is no, but I can tell you that I would, if I had to choose between that person and someone who's taking care of 5 7-year-olds, I would choose that person, definitely. The other benefit of taking care of these kids is, and again, I don't know how many 18-month-old babies are being taken care of in dental offices receiving general anesthesia. I think that's probably extremely rare.
For sure.
Yeah.
If they're treated, they're probably treated without sedation.
Without sedation, correct. So, I mean, you know, the ages are probably more like 3 to 8.
No, I would say 3 to 8.
With a minimum of 3. But the other benefit is it familiarizes those, not just the sedationist, but those caring for those patients too. So in a COPE situation, you're going to want to have staff who have seen kids before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an emotional experience to run a code on a pediatric patient.
Yeah.
And so if you have a nurse or a dental assistant or a dance or whatever, a young assistant who has never taken care of a kid and is now being asked to do chest compressions on a 7-year-old, I would argue that that's not going to be a very effective situation at that moment. So familiarity becomes extremely important in these situations.
Mm-hmm.
100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I may step in, I'm on a call and I don't know how to raise my hand. My name is Andy Ray. I work with Randy Blazek, president of the Society of Oral Maxillofacial Surgeons, and just want to echo some of his sentiments that he said earlier. In general terms, you know, I think Dr. Jermaine was talking about the safety concerns with children, which we wholeheartedly agree with. In general terms, talking about this issue with other members of the state, they're categorically against any kind of pediatric designation. While we recognize the importance of this, you know, special patient population, the like the data and all the AMIS papers suggest that the LMST model is very safe and effective in reducing access to care.
So this is Dr. German. Thanks, Dr. Ray. I appreciate you being here. I don't know of any data about, you know, OMFS data to show safety of this patient age. I think the most recent article actually was shared by Dr. Christensen from the Mayo Clinic, who had a very impressive amount of cases. One of the exclusion criteria were patients under 14. So they weren't even included in that study, which actually opens up a lot of questions on my part. But, what is the actual safety record for this age group? Do we actually know?
No.
I'm not arguing or contesting the anesthesia care model of the OMFS.
I think if you're asking about a specific age group, like under 4, I don't think they're. My comment is just in general echoes what Dr. Blazek said. So much of what we learn in residency in anesthesia training, probably more so than other anesthesia providers, is patient selection. Because we have the opportunity to provide anesthesia in our office or bring an anesthesia provider or go to surgery center hospital, of which I do all three of those.
Yeah.
And I think so much of the safety looking at just the data here in Arizona is based on that our ability is patient selection. And I can't speak for other specialties. I can't speak for pediatric dentists and periodontists, but speaking for oral surgeons, being in dental anesthesia, ambulatory anesthesia for decades, that's one of the first things that's taught in residency is patient selection. And so I know people, if they're not comfortable treating, let's say a 4 or 5 year old, they don't do it. They have options. And I think again, that's where the safety lies. And I don't have any paper that can cite you offhand about, 4 or 5 year olds in an oral surgeon's office with the safety outcomes related to those. I can look a little bit further about a specific age, but I think just in general terms.
Mrs.
Blazing. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'll be quick.
Yeah.
I mean, options are always good, right? If you're flying, you like options. And it's good that you guys do have those types of options and abilities to a surgery center or to a hospital. The argument works kind of both ways, though. If you have the options, then that child can be treated. I think that it's a couple of things you have to look at is a child with like an ankylosed tooth or trauma where it might be a little bit more urgent than other types of cases. And so if you were to set that requirement for me, it gives me a little anxiety if we're going to set this type of age limit that low. I think 6 to 8, where there is some pointers to those references, is kind of a good place to be. But I do think that the lower the number that age, whether it's on that end of the spectrum, does help with the access to the care for children. Because if you set it at 12, then you would get some that don't treat that and they would fall the other direction. But I do think that options are good. I do think that you have to think about how those experiences are counted with providers working with other oral surgeon providers. There's a difference in the practice that's working on a child that at least has another oral surgeon that is present. Mm-hmm. And what you do with those cases, that it's a trauma case, right? It's a mm-hmm. kid that the pediatric dentist isn't comfortable taking out that mesh of teeth because they fell. And then mm-hmm. you sutured up and you don't have access to the hospital that acutely. So there is a lot to think about, but I do agree with the staying current and having those numbers. I mean, you see that in other industries as well, and that holds true. You can only do what you do, right? It's like what we do is what mm-hmm. we know.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's a problem with treating or getting those numbers, it's difficult.
Then maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
Right.
What you're saying. Yeah. I'm hearing you guys loud and clear. I really am. And ironically, I did look at our AO thing that you and I put together, Dr. German, and it's funny. Almost all of them were 6 and under, other than 2 were 8-year-olds.
Right.
Yeah, so the majority were 6 and under. And there is no data out there.
That's the only data we really have, though. I mean, in the state, if you're looking for outcomes and things, that's what the state board
is. This is loud. At national level, there's really not a database.
There's not a database.
That's
not
a good one.
That's what I was going to say.
I know AAPD is working on one. Mm-hmm. So it's because we really don't have that. Mm-hmm. So I know that they're working at that at the national level. How long it's going to take, I don't know. It's probably a year or two away. But there's just not good data.
This is Snell. I'm not in the peer world, but is there an issue with Dr. Blazer or Dr. Christensen with an age limit, or is it just the age, what age we set that limit at?
I don't have a problem with the age limit. I think it's the age.
The age you set it at.
Like I don't really like 8. I'll just tell you right off the bat. And I'm partial to, I would say 5 to 6. I mean, I hate to make it sound like a negotiation, but like it's so routine for me to do someone who's 7 and 8 years old and say, I mean, that's just routine. I mean, I every month I'm seeing the mesiodens, and so to me, make those numbers are easy.
Right.
I have colleagues that probably those numbers aren't so easy. They would be just kind of getting in there, like they would maybe do 19, let's say, or whatever the number would be. So maybe we lower the age and we lower the number of requirements. I don't know, man, something like that.
This is Christensen. I guess, you know, we talked about we wanting data to look at. So if you looked at the data that we were presented in the adverse outcome, you know, committee meeting that we had, what would you come out of that saying that an oral maxillofacial surgeon needs to have an age limitation for the safety of the kids in Arizona? Looking at just, I mean, the data that we have that you were provided, would you come away with feeling like that? I'm curious.
This is Brady. I, you know, it's hard. It's really hard because it's like, I don't necessarily, I agree with you with the data that we just have here. And you also have to look at how many cases are safely done, which we don't know, but we can have a speculation. And it's a pretty educated guess that there's has to be hundreds of thousands of people sedated throughout the year in the state of Arizona for multiple years with a length of a good safety run. And so even though we don't know exactly what that denominator is, we have been doing things fairly safely. I think that said, I think oral surgeons either probably self-reflect, like, I'm not going to treat this child because they are too young, even though it's not a rule, because we are professionals and we make those clinical judgments by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something to be said that say, well, let's talk about currency. And, you know, the pilot in me speaks out because I know that I can't go night flying unless I've done three landings with night flights. And I can't do that unless I have a safety pilot with me to get up to that currency. So I get that concept of safety as well. I agree. Yeah. Go ahead.
This is German. Brady, I mean, I obviously I'm totally with you on this. You know, I think there's a lot of validity to numbers. I think there's, you know, it just passes the common sense test in my mind. But let me just ask you guys a question. You don't have to answer it, but I really want us to think about this. Where would you take your six-year-old child? Would you take them to be anesthetized by someone who has not cared for a six-year-old child in the last 5 years?
No.
Or would you go somewhere where they do it a lot?
Mm-hmm.
You would go somewhere where they do it a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why hold our kids to a different standard than the kids of the community? Why would we not set some sort of limit? So at least we can say that, hey, we're trying, we're doing something, we're thinking about this. Now, if we get a database 5 years from now, things may completely change. But at least we're following industry standards. I mean, this is the only organization that doesn't have these type of limits for taking care of kids. It's in every hospital, every surgery center, every residency program, fellowship program. I mean, they're focused on quotas, standards for pediatric patients. But I can take my six-year-old to any dental office here in the state of Arizona, and he can be sedated, and I will have no clue about the competency of that person providing sedation.
Mm-hmm.
Jessica, you got your hand up?
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to point out, I really like the direction that your discussion is going, because when it comes to rules and putting any sort of restrictions on your licensees, when it comes to pediatric care, the Governor's Regulatory Review Council, who reviews all of these rules before they can go into effect and approves them, will definitely be looking at what sort of data you relied on and considered in setting those restrictions and those limitations. So I'm glad to hear that you guys are looking at other states. You're looking at other industries who treat pediatric patients in Arizona. And I think you're on the right track with basing your limitations on the data that's available, limited as it may be.
Thank you, Jessica.
Hey, this is Allie. I think Dr. German makes a really good point talking about what we would want for our children. I think one of the hardest things when you're, you know, making recommendations for rule change that affect, you know, the entire state, you know, there's always this difficult balance between safety and access, right? You know, as I'm thinking about this age limit and whether it should be lowered, you know, one thing that comes to my mind, and you know, I do quite a bit of pediatric cases in dental offices, at least in oral surgeons' offices, and the vast majority of them are, you know, between 5 and 10. And if I think about it, if we lowered this limit to 5, like if we made it age 5, I'd maybe have a hard time scraping, you know, say finding 10 cases in a year. I might, right? So it brings up the question, like, does that mean that I should not be able to do them? And maybe I shouldn't, right? I mean, that's, I guess that's the question of, like, maybe I shouldn't. But then if that I can't, and I'm primarily doing, you know, 6, 7, 8-year-olds, and we move this limit to 5, you know, where are those kids under 5 going to necessarily go? Especially when you start thinking about outside of an urban metro, right? So, like, in the Phoenix area, Tucson area, like that's going to be pretty easy for them to find an office that does a whole lot of pediatrics under the age of 5. But, you know, you look at the rural parts of our state, you know, so I don't know. You know, when I think of that in mind, it makes me think maybe 8 is the right number. But, you know, that's kind of where my head is at, is that balance between safety and access.
Can I ask a question? This is Blazek. What did we, how would we see this playing out, like how the individual shows verification of doing a certain number of cases, whether it's 10 or 20? Is it just an affidavit?
I think they. I would think they'd actually.
That's currently what it is now. You just, when you go in to do a site exam or whatever, you just show that, hey, there's been proof that 10 a year have been done.
Don't they have to present actual cases like a record with the patient information redacted?
Yeah, they pull that. You can pull an audit.
Well, yeah, the 1303, we have cases waiting for us, the documentation to go over with.
Right. So you just have to pull the note.
Provide us with 10 cases a year, and then we look at the different cases and go from there.
This is Beanstalk. We have logs in our office of all the cases and the ages of those patients.
You know, what's funny about it, Ms. Blazek, it was the hardest thing for me to actually get the number of it's a terrible situation we're in where we don't have a database. But, like, my staff put in, like, you know, 3.5 hours to figure out how many these cases you did, because we don't really track it by age. We track it by the, you know, anesthetic code. And then you go through the anesthetic code, and then they counted them up. But, I think in the interest of safety and, what have you, it is a very good idea. I'd like us to get together on an age and a number of cases and move forward on this, John. I mean, I think it's a good move. You're right. It is, it's progressive. It's the right way to go. It's what everybody's, it's proving that you're providing a safer mechanism, or we're observing people or making sure they're doing safe anesthesia. So we should get to an age and get to a number.
This is Lau. I think the subcommittee, one of the discussions why we wanted to keep it at 8 versus going down to 6 or 5 was because you would have more cases to,
mm-hmm.
to do. So I think that was a little leniency.
It's easier to
get the required cases, correct.
Ms. Bray, that's right. It's just an inverse of how you're looking at it. If you're trying to get the endorsement, if you're trying to take care of the mm-hmm. patients that are older than that.
But if your 8-year-old is over 80 kilos, we won't count them.
I got a lot of those, dude.
Actually, they should count twice.
Yeah, right. I know California has a similar – what's California's – what did they do to you guys?
What is Brady? Well, in Mississippi, we did implement this, so this is within their regulations now. And it's in the infancy of it. So right now, it's an attestation to get to the next permit. And then after that, it's going to be case logged. But they're actually going to – their board meeting was today, so I don't know if it passed or not. But they're actually going to ask for an extension to that 2022 just because the age population has been so disruptive with COVID and them trying to figure out the numbers. Like you said, it's a pretty daunting task to try to figure out where one is at depending on – their databases within themselves and figure out where they stand.
It's easy to go forward, but to go back is pretty tough.
Mm-hmm. And it felt like it was necessary too, because then it gives the opportunity for people that are providing this type of service on what direction they want to go with it. Do they want to go ahead and get credentials with a surgical center or bring in anesthesia provider, or how they're going to manage that patient care population. And there's still that question of what do you do when you get the call in the middle of the night and my kid fell and busted open his palate and teeth.
Eddie and I can tell you what they do.
Please enlighten us.
They call it. I mean, actually, yeah, even the dentists don't do that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so that even though I agree with this rule and this yeah. way that we go, we need to think about those things. Mm-hmm. And I think in Mississippi, they're like, well, how does someone get those experiences? If it's another oral surgeon, I think I sent it to the committee, those types of questions and answers that the oral surgery committee had, or within the state of Mississippi, their society had mm-hmm. about the age. And there were some things that the anesthesia panel came up with to help with that regard. So if you were to have another provider in there that was current and you were helping them with that case, that would count towards that experience as well. Mm. So there's like some questions. What about this scenario? What about that?
Yeah,
scenario?
I'm right.
Right.
So maybe this is German. Maybe, I don't know, Dr. Brady, you seem to be, I don't want to say infiltrated, but for lack of a better term, infiltrated among these other state dental boards. Do you think you could help us get those numbers, see what age group is more commonly used, which case requirements they're utilizing, and maybe at our next meeting we can take a vote on age and case requirements?
Ms. Brady, I would be satisfied to do that. And I'll probably get you a subcommittee connected with a couple of the oral surgeons on that panel and also the state chapter of that panel. It would be very helpful getting from their perspective, too. On that subcommittee. So if we could arrange a meeting, that would
awesome.
A subcommittee meeting just on that would accommodate. So.
Awesome.
And this is Dr. Beanstalk, something to think about. And I can't speak for Dr. Lau, but the 6-year molars come in at age 6. It's the first adult tooth, right? So if we do 6 and under, I think that's, I would be fine with that if we changed it to 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as Blazik, I would think that's probably a pretty good call. 6-year molars. That's actually interesting. I didn't think of it that way.
This is Christensen. I just another thing when looking at those adverse outcomes. Any of these regulations that we're setting up now, would they have prevented any of those negative outcomes that happened in this state in the last 8 years? That's what I'd like to ask everybody right now. We're talking about regulating. But with those regulations, with those rules that would have been put in place, would they have prevented any of these adverse outcomes that happened in terrible outcomes that happened in the state?
This is German. I have no idea what the denominator of kids were for these providers who had these adverse outcomes.
Yeah, to know the answer to that question, we would have to know how many cases the provider in those bad outcomes with kids, how many cases they've done in the last 2 years, right?
Is that something we're finding out before we start this regulatory process?
This is great. I don't disagree with you. And I think from when we went to executive session, we would not be able to identify one. So I don't know, from your point is well taken. It's not I don't think that you're going to find that from within this state, within the past 8 years, if that would have made a difference. Or even, obviously, when an adverse event happens and a tragedy happens, there's many different things that could have happened, too. It may not necessarily have been just related because of that type of regulatory position, even if that was in place, whether that would have changed an outcome or not. It's hard to say that accordingly.
And I think that is in line with Jessica's comments regarding rule changes that are going to go to the governor's office. What data is behind them to spark that change? So, good point.
Well, this is Blazik, and I'm reading the studies here. And you know what, Eddie, it's kind of interesting in my mind as I read a couple of these adverse occurrences. If these anesthesia providers weren't doing a lot of kids, the case would have gone worse. Because the majority of these adverse occurrences on the kids, they didn't pass away, they didn't die, no brain death and stuff, and they reacted appropriately and they handled the emergency. So if you look at it, I think the flip side, they're not being regulated in this scenario, but they're doing lots of cases because I know these providers, you know. So
this is Brady. There's one other thing I'd like to bring up, and that was a study that was referenced within the subcommittee about cases and the study of how doing 100 cases versus 200 cases, and how that made a five-fold increase in safety. So even though retrospectively we might not, it's really foggy to see what we're trying to achieve from a regulatory standpoint, because it's not really an identifier that we're like, does that big thing happen? What can we do to build a safety net to it? This is more like being progressive, taking the information from those types of studies and what other industries are doing. So we may get some pushback from if this moves forward out of the committee for that suggestion, is what our identifiers are going to be for that regulatory change.
This is Christensen. I'm not opposed to some of the things that are being discussed here, not at all. I agree with a lot of what's being said. I just think when we start asking for additional regulations and things like that, it needs to make sense. And some of these cases and what's precipitated some of the stuff that's come out of California, it's been very high profile stuff that's initiated some of these changes. And so I don't want to be reactionary. I do want to be progressive, but I don't want to be reactionary and make an emotional decision on things. And everybody's done a great job. I you know, really appreciate everybody's good work in here. I just really want to think through it and make sure that it makes sense to add additional regulations. But something that, if you look at what we have so far, and I know Dr. Snell mentioned that time, I think we've done a good job. Can we do better? Absolutely. That's why we're here. So I'm going to take it somewhere. We'll see what happens here.
So we'll talk about getting some more data, coming back to the next meeting, and maybe setting the number of cases that will be required and the age. And we're all in agreement, I think, here and on the phone, that's the where we want to move to on this idea.
I agree.
Just before we move on, I did have one quick question about the recommendations. I'm more curious on this than anything, but the so let's say there's a general dentist that wants to get a 1302 permit and sedate pediatric patients. Are there avenues for them to be able to get 60 hours of training in pediatric airway anatomy, medical conditions, sedation, and emergencies?
This is Snell. To my knowledge, that would be very, very difficult for a general dentist to get that type of training, and I don't think most general dentists care to be treating that type of patient. Dr. Hero can probably speak to that as well, but
yeah,
I think it's pretty much a non-issue when you start talking about those young age groups for general dentists and sedation.
Okay. Well, and now you're
for IV moderate,
on a
child
that if they're requiring sedations, they're probably not cooperative to begin with.
Correct.
Getting their IV. I mean, it brings up a slew of questions, but there's probably not a pathway for that for a reason.
Well, then take away forget about the 1302. Let's say it's a 1303 general dentist that wants to do oral sedation in pediatric patients. Is there avenues for them to get 60 hours of training?
Yeah, this is Lau. There are some avenues to do that. I think Docs has a pretty active pediatric sedation program. I think they even have hands-on cases and things like that. So there are some that that can do that for pediatric sedation.
Okay.
This is Brady. I think how we address that in Mississippi is that if you had the 60 hours of training in the IV sedation course, because you have to be able to treat medical emergencies, therefore you have to know IV drugs. And then it was an additional 20 hours, I believe, on top of that. It wasn't an additional 60 all over again, because a lot of that is going to be overlapping information. So first you have to do a IV moderate sedation permit course to learn how to manage the emergency in that experience not to be able to do moderate sedation with children to get that baseline knowledge of how they came up with that rationale. And then it was an additional 20 hours for the pediatric portion of that. And I don't know enough about the doc course pediatric course as far as how many hours
that is. Yeah, that's just an example that I see out there.
Okay.
I know they've started this pediatric one. It's probably been out about 3 or 4 years now. I know that they have some didactic training, and it might be close to 60. And then they have hands-on cases where somebody is supervising them.
So that was a live patient?
Correct.
Not for them actually doing
it. Yes, and it's minimal to moderate sedation, oral sedation.
Correct.
So it's for non-pediatric dentists to gain experience and work on pediatric patients.
And this is Brady again. There was just a publication from the ADA for teaching the pediatric for general dentists, not throughout residency. You know, those are everything guidelines of those recommendations that are in published ADA.
Are they similar to that? Is that what you're asking? Or?
Correct.
I think they're somewhat similar to them.
Yep.
They're also similar, ironically, to the – they're very similar to what the ASDA put out.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also very similar to what Texas has done. And also, I think they mimic California a little bit, too.
Okay.
And just from lack of – I think Dr. Beanstein and myself, Beanstock and myself have recommended 25 cases, whereas these have 20 cases. So everybody's kind of close in that format.
And
the different regulatory agencies, the different specialties.
Right. And this is Brady. And I know Mississippi is looking at maybe even increasing that requirement. And so that's a lot of those questions I'm more just inquiring myself to.
This is Chris. I do have one question. I know we talked about this on Thursday's phone meeting. You know, for a permit holder, you know, 1301 or whatever, if they're close to those numbers, you know, some of them are going to want to maintain some sort of pediatric designation on their license. What avenues, you know, I know we talked a little bit about that. Would they count OR cases if they're there for induction, wake up, or another provider comes in, or, you know, another surgeon or another anesthesia provider comes in? Do somebody younger, how is that kind of
I think we had kind of talked, this is loud, we had talked about that a little bit on Thursday night. I think probably the best approach for that would be just people coming back with ideas for that. You know, if you think about it, what would be a good way for people to be able to get cases.
That's going to be a question I think a lot of people have.
Exactly. And that, I think we tossed that around a little bit.
This is German. I think that's an excellent question, especially for someone who's just kind of right there with the numbers. And I think there's tons of different ways we can pursue that, but I think the key word is familiarity. So exposure, familiarity. But yeah, I think we should add that to the discussion for our next, you know, meeting, but there's lots
of. That'd be a nice way to iron it out.
Yeah. One of the preliminary talks about that. I mean, I do think working involved with the community, I know, working with oral surgeons, and I don't think that it's just me, myself, it's a lot of people have said that. We do enjoy working with other different provider types, and we would open up an invitation to have people come in and spend a day with us. I do that all the time, whether it's with residents or dental students applying to residency or people that are interested or even had oral surgeons apply. I'll spend time with you as well, just to get more familiarity with working with the actual population. So I do think there's opportunity out there for people that are right on the bubble to say, hey, look, can I spend a day with you, a couple of days with you, or something of that nature. But we can explore those options.
I think.
So, Randy, you and Ed, you guys have some, do you have dental anesthesiologists that come into your office?
I've worked with them and some CRNAs
and MDAs. I think that's a good option, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a great point because you don't want to deter a provider from taking a case to the hospital, bringing in a dental anesthesiologist, because they need to get a couple more cases in. And if they're doing cases and utilizing another anesthesia provider, my opinion, it's something to talk about, but that should be lumped in together, regardless of what permit holder and where the case designation lies. I look at my own office, for example. We have two full-time anesthesiologists. One's an MD, one's a dental anesthesiologist. I'm a 1302 permit holder.
but oftentimes I'll defer to in a case that I could do safely and comfortably to have an anesthesiologist do it because it's even safer.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a regulatory requirement for me to do so many cases, am I now going to do this case on my own to meet that requirement when I could be safely doing it with somebody else that's in the office? So I said it's a great point. With that said, right, if there's any other more comments on the notice for proposed rulemaking, I think we've got some subcommittee work to do. You know, we can move on.
You had just mentioned last time, asked me to look at definitions. Does that fall under this section?
I think this one is pretty well encompassed.
Okay. And I don't know, I didn't send these out because I thought these two topics were going to go longer than they did. So if you want me to send out one, there are just some, like, even oral sedation, like, that's an outdated term, but it's all throughout the rules.
Why don't you send it out and have everybody kind of read it, and then I think it'll be more fruitful conversation.
Okay.
So agenda item number 5, the ASVA proposed state sedation general anesthesia rules. Were there, I mean, some of these agenda items, I think, were kind of rolled into number 4.
Yeah, this is great. You know, at this point, everyone has in that read through it. I think we've read this quite a few different times. But unless I can open up any questions regarding that if we have any, but I think it's kind of just worked in hand as an aid. We've been working through agenda item number 4.
That may be true with agenda item number 6 as well. Regulations.
Yeah.
Okay. So if there's no discussion on those two agenda items, we can move to 7, study review of adverse occurrence reports. Do you know why this is on this here for a reason?
Yeah, it's just a continuation so that you guys always have the chart available to look at.
This is Blazik. I will say there were a couple areas in there. It's been a while, but I know there were some things that Dr. German and I had questions on still, like we wanted to look at some of the cases. Can we have that opportunity to essentially finish the study at that point, or – I guess I'd ask the rest of the committee, do we need to do any more work on the study? I mean, do we want to have an official blue ribbon study like you saw out of California and Texas? And I think to do that, there were some cases that Dr. German and I both were like, we wanted to review the record again because some things were unclear.
Yeah, and I mean, to further that, I think there were some cases we weren't really able to talk about, and there's some other ones that are coming down the pipeline that it may be worthwhile to keep it open so that we have the ability to go back to executive session, re-review cases, and continue discussions.
Okay. I would, this is Blazik again, I would say, and pertaining to that, we could certainly put that further down on the list. I think what's more important are the things we're talking about now, what we've already established for the next meeting to talk about with the fees designation, with the definitions. I would definitely put those higher on the list.
Yeah.
You know, and we can make our study wait a little bit. One of the things I was wondering how we introduce it or we make it like an actual plan is we've many times talked about making this committee a standing committee. So how do we begin that process? Does it need to be on this agenda? Where are we at with that?
Well, so let's move down a couple of agenda items and then get to that.
Okay.
So we'll move on to a summary of current events. Anybody have any comments there?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Well, one is, so our public member, Nick Goodman, has stepped off the committee. He was chair. I think I've inherited that role, whether I like it or not. He did want me to pass along. He had it was a great learning experience for him while he was on here. He really enjoyed it. He felt like his ability to contribute probably wasn't, to the level of the time commitment that it was taking. So I wanted to say adios to everybody.
You did a great job.
Thank you, Doctor. Then let's move on to discussion and possible action items for future meeting agendas. And so we'll jump right into Dr. Blazik's question about how do we, and I think it would be a statutory change, is that right, Brian, to try to create this committee to be a standing committee?
Well, yeah, eventually, especially if you're going to want to, not that anybody's doing this to earn a living, but for payment to be rendered to
for committee time, either for review or attending a meeting, we would have to put it, it'd have to go through legislation to be placed in the board statute.
Okay.
But I think that, and Seth, you can jump in here and virtually punch me in the face if I say too much, but I think that the impetus was to have a committee to review cases prior to the board. And I think that what the board has just done as a current event was to create an investigative committee that will hopefully include dentist anesthesiologists, general dentists, you know, some – the board will have to establish that exactly.
A broad spectrum of specialists and general dentists.
And so I think that once this committee has its task as far as – amending or revising or adding a pediatric designation or whatever to the rules, it may have completed its task and therefore no longer be needed, because I don't know that we have enough cases that we would have to have an anesthesia committee to review, whereas an investigative committee could do that as easy.
But some of these members, Christensen, some of these members could ask to be on that investigative committee. Is that
yeah,
correct?
Absolutely.
We could all still get together for happy hour, though, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
If you're buying.
I think you need a pediatric designation for that.
I think there's an M for Mormon designation. Any more discussion on possible future items?
Well, that's not a future item. Yeah, okay, forget it. I'm done.
Then we'll move on. Number 10, next committee meeting date is August 17th. Is that a Tuesday?
Yeah. Yeah, they alternate. And I know that, like, in fact, some Tuesdays work for people better than Fridays. Some, they don't work at all. So it's kind of what you guys agreed upon.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just changed. So if you can't make it, don't fret. As long as we have a quorum, we should be okay. So, and that meeting will continue to be in a kind of a hybrid format where it's virtual attendance or in person. So whatever you're comfortable doing.
Great. Then we'll move on to adjournment. Anybody want to make a motion to adjourn?
Hey, Dr. Hero.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry to interrupt. I've had my hand up for a really long time.
I'm sorry, Dr. Arnold. This laptop went on and off a few times and I missed that. Why don't you go ahead?
I was trying to be respectful and not interrupt, but I've wanted to make a comment for quite a while. I just wanted to say, speaking for the Arizona Society of Dentist Anesthesiologists, that and this goes way back in the discussion today. I just want to say that we do support the idea of permitting non-dentist providers with the 1304 that you were speaking of, and we do feel that since they'll be doing the same kind of anesthesia as a 1301 permit, that it should have the exact same requirements, essentially the identical requirements to a 1301 permit. And as I said, our society gives support to that. Our society also gives support to the pediatric endorsement. And I would say, among all the providers in the dental world, dentist anesthesiologists probably put the most pediatric patients under general anesthesia within the age group that we're talking about. And we give our support for that pediatric endorsement. Now, not speaking for the society, just my personal thought, I think rather than say that anyone who completed a residency automatically gets the pediatric endorsement, I think it would be easier to say if we know that the requirements of their residency fulfill our requirements for the pediatric endorsement that they get it. But if we don't know, then it should be by portfolio.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Arnold.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you letting me speak up at the end. And now I'll be quiet.
All right, then can I get a motion for adjournment?
I'll motion.
I motion, yeah.
Second. A motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Meeting adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Call me in, Blazik.
Yeah, call me in, Blazik.
Have a great weekend, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care,
Bye.
Take care. Bye. Good talk. Good Lisa and Ollie.